From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon. This is Sarah Perry in for Tony Perkins, and you are with us on Washington Watch. It is a Friday in Washington, D.C., and that, of course, means we have plenty to talk about. Just today, in the midst of a Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives, President Trump got some much-needed good news from the courts. A decision was handed down in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, barring most individuals that identify as transgender from service in the military. Our own Peter Sprigg joins me at the top of the show. In our second segment, Republican Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler of Missouri joins me to discuss her rejection of newly minted House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's radical push for abortion and funding of abortion overseas. At 32 past the hour, I'll address the outrageous and bigoted remarks that two Democratic senators made about the Knights of Columbus during the course of a Senate judicial confirmation hearing. Supreme Knight Carl Anderson joins me in the Washington Watch hotline from New Haven, Connecticut. And as our last segment wraps up, we will have a discussion about Apple and our continuation on big tech censorship, about a Christian app that helps those struggling with unwanted same-sex attraction, and what happened to that app in the Apple store. Ricky Shillette, president of Living Hope Ministries, joins me today from Arlington, Texas. I've got Peter Sprigg with me today. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sarah. Good to be with you.
So today, in the 14th day of the partial governmental shutdown, President Trump is really hoping Democrats in the House are going to find him somewhere in the middle on the compromise for the border wall. So the House has offered up some compromise, which really does some things we'll talk about the next segment, but it's very little of what he wants, and he's desperate for some good news. Today, the U.S. Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a Trump administration policy barring certain individuals who identify as transgender from serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. So you, as the senior fellow for policy studies, would you give us a sense of what this decision actually said?
Well, let me review the history as briefly as I can here of this policy. For decades, for most of American history, there was no question that that people who identified as transgender were considered disqualified for military service, both on psychological grounds and, if they had had gender reassignment surgery, on physical health grounds as well. That policy prevailed not only through most of history, but through the first 7.5 years of the Obama administration, and was only changed at the end of June, beginning of July 2016, by President Obama and then Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, who adopted a policy to allow transgenders and people who identify as transgender and people who have had gender transition medical procedures to serve in the military. Well, about a year later, after President Trump took office in July of 2017, he announced initially via Twitter, that he was going to reverse that policy and return to the previous longstanding historic policy of considering those who identify as transgender to be disqualified.
So not a drastic decision on his part, simply going back to the pre-Obama era
right.
of service in the military.
Exactly. Reversing a policy that had only been in place for about a year and returning to the previous policy. Now, of course, Twitter does not a policy make, and so this was fleshed out a little bit more with a presidential memorandum in August with some interim regulations from the Department of Defense in September of 2017. And then Secretary of Defense James Mattis, put together a team to actually study this issue in a systematic way, which the Obama administration, incidentally, had not done. And then in accordance with the president's instructions, by in March of last year, 2018, the secretary released and referred to the president a very detailed report and recommendations, 44-page-long document, proposing a new policy and that would exclude from the military people who have been diagnosed with gender dysphoria, which not everyone who identifies as transgender has been diagnosed with gender dysphoria, and people who have had any sort of gender transition, who have undertaken a gender transition, which, again, not everyone who identifies as transgender has done that either. But the meanwhile in the courts, though, as soon as President Trump issued that tweet in the summer of 2017, lawsuits were immediately filed to try to block this policy. So there wasn't even really a policy on paper, but there were already lawsuits to prevent this policy.
Right.
And there were actually four of them, and in all four of these cases, four district court judges all issued preliminary injunctions to prevent the implementation of the new Trump policy. Well, what happened with, as I understand this, I had to kind of sort this out from the news today, but in the one case, I think it was the first case that was filed in the D.C., in the District of Columbia, after the comprehensive policy was announced in March, the administration went back to the court and said, okay, your preliminary injunction was based on a policy that didn't exist at the time. Now that we have a new policy, this is a new situation. Your preliminary injunction doesn't apply anymore. Therefore, please lift the preliminary injunction. The district court refused to do that. What the circuit court today did was to say the district court was wrong in that case because they were wrong to say that the March policy was not a new policy. And they were wrong to say that it was basically a blanket exclusion of transgender people. The March 2018 Mattis plan, as it's referred to, actually is very careful in sort of adopting a more up-to-date understanding of gender identity and so forth that is consistent with the American Psychiatric Association. But at the same time, it uses this definition of gender dysphoria as a specific diagnosis. It does not exclude everyone who's transgender, namely people who identify with the opposite sex from their biological sex. Only those who've been formally diagnosed with gender dysphoria and those who have actually undertaken a gender transition.
Let's talk about the gender dysphoria notion. So this is a psychiatric diagnosis. How does gender dysphoria differ from being transgender? They're two separate things, but can you explain to our listeners what the difference is between both of those?
Sure. Previous to 2013, there was a condition in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders published by the American Psychiatric Association that was called gender identity disorder. Now, transgender people took issue with they were offended by the term disorder, for one thing, and they took issue with the idea that it's somehow inherently a disordered condition to have this, what they call gender incongruity, where your psychological gender identity is different from your physical biological sex. So it was changed to gender dysphoria, and gender dysphoria is defined as a sense of distress that is caused by the existence of gender incongruity. So gender incongruity makes you transgender, but only if you have serious distress from that condition are you considered to have gender dysphoria. Well, even the Obama policy required a diagnosis of gender dysphoria before someone could change their public gender identity within the military. And so actually the Mattis plan followed that but said those with gender dysphoria are pose a risk to military readiness and therefore should be excluded from military service.
So we're dealing with the last of four suits because there were injunctions that were upheld in the other three federal courts. So now this is the last sort of peg to fall. So what practical import does this have, if any, on individuals who identify as transgender in active military service right now?
Well, one of the things I should have mentioned was that the Mattis plan actually grandfathered in the people who had already begun a gender transition under the Obama plan that began in 2016. So there were 937 of those people who had been diagnosed with gender dysphoria and had begun a gender transition plan. And those people would be allowed to continue to serve. This does not change anything at the moment because it's not a final disposition on the merits, and the preliminary injunction in the other three court cases is still in place. However, this at least gives us some hope that there are some people in the courts who will have a reasonable view of this. First, an understanding of what the Mattis plan is, and secondly, a respect for the power of the elected branches of government to make the military personnel decisions. It's really not up to the courts. It is up to Congress and the president to make military personnel decisions. Now, in this case, Congress has not ever enacted legislation on this particular issue. That makes this a little bit different from the whole debate over homosexuals in the military, where you had a statute. Here, it has always been a matter of executive branch policy. And if I could just read the one excerpt from today's decision, it says, "We must recognize that the Mattis plan plausibly relies upon the considered professional judgment of appropriate military officials." Those are quotes from previous precedents. "And appears to permit some transgender individuals to serve in the military consistent with established military mental health, physical health, and sex-based standards." So those three factors, the mental health, physical health considerations, and sex-based standards, were at the heart of this 44-page document issued by Secretary Mattis. And this shows a real understanding both of the executive power to make this decision and of the legitimate justification that underlies it, even though this is not a final decision on the merits.
And it really goes to the question, as it should, of military readiness, which is fully within the power of the executive branch to make a determination on once he had determined that he would get the appropriate individuals, made that secondary pass, took Mattis's advice after consulting with military officials, and made the declaration, okay, we're going to come back now. We've modified the plan. The plan meets these military readiness needs without compromising the civil rights of the individuals who want to serve the military, and leaves approximately 900 to 1,000 individuals who identify as transgender in active service. So going to that gender issue, let me mention quickly, is this a function of a broader trend? We know, for example, that New York City's council just recently passed and Mayor de Blasio signed into law a new regulation that identifies individuals with the option for an X on a birth certificate. Is this emblematic of something that is becoming a cultural trend?
Well, yeah, this is the thing. I try to explain to people the whole transgender issue is really not about discrimination. It's not about that we just don't like this kind of person. That is really not the issue. The issue is you have this concept of gender identity, which is psychological. You have biological sex. Which is a more reasonable way of identifying somebody as male or female? It's a conflict of philosophies, and there's no particular reason why we should adopt the transgender view.
Peter, we could talk about this for quite some time. I always love talking with you. Our senior fellow for policy studies, Peter Sprigg, has joined us today. Coming up next on Washington Watch, I will talk with Republican Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler from the 4th District of Missouri.
This Christmas, give a gift with purpose. Your gift to Family Research Council enables us to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a Christian worldview. Together, we will work to ensure religious liberty for all Americans is upheld, unborn babies in the womb are protected, and biblical values are honored in our country. Your giving can make an eternal difference for your community and for future generations. And if you give between now and December 31st to FRC, your gift will be doubled by a generous challenge match. Any donation is tax deductible. Be fruitful in your gift giving this season. Call 1-800-225-4008. Or visit frc.org/2018 to donate. Again, that number is 1-800-225-4008 and frc.org/2018. Thank you for standing with us. FRC wishes you and your family a Merry Christmas and a Blessed New Year.
We are inviting you to join other like-minded people and become a STAN member. We want to build stronger relationships with listeners like you and provide resources to strengthen your faith and equip you to stand for the values that matter to you of life, marriage, and religious freedom. By joining this growing network of engaged believers, you'll receive a copy of Tony Perkins' book, No Fear, detailing courageous Christians standing for truth. And for a limited time this month, we will also send you a copy of Pastor Carter Conlon's book, It's Time to Pray, that illustrates how God's power can change everything. Take action today and become an FRC STAN member for $17 a month. That's just 56 cents a day. To join, call 1-800-225-4008 or visit frc.org/stand. That's 1-800-225-4008 or visit frc.org/stand. Thank you for partnering with us. The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Well, as promised, Nancy Pelosi's first act as a newly minted Speaker of the House was showboating a measure that would have ended the 12-day partial shutdown. She told reporters demonstrably, "We are asking the president to open up the government." What she didn't mention is that her bill would also be reopening up something else, a global pipeline for taxpayer-funded abortion. After almost 2 years, President Trump reinstated the Mexico City policy. A new majority tried to upend it with language that would ship American tax dollars overseas to groups that promote abortion. Our next guest on Washington Watch has challenged Pelosi's push for abortion over the years. Republican Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler from the 4th District of Missouri, who has been a staunch ally of both the unborn and of FRC, joins us today on the program. Congresswoman, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Good to be here.
Congresswoman, you have expressed concern that the Democrats' funding bill, of which they have made much noise, strips away essential protections for young mothers and unborn babies. And as I'm thinking about the individuals who might be listening to this program, all they hear is funding for the government and reopening of 25% of the government. So in theory, people are really only getting a part of the story. But it's extremely problematic. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the specific pro-abortion inclusions in this funding bill?
Absolutely. It's very disappointing that the first act of now Speaker Nancy Pelosi was to reinstate some pro-abortion policies from the past. And namely, she wanted to go after and eliminate President Trump's Protecting Life and Global Health Assistance Program, which was an expanded version of the Mexico City policy, basically saying if we're going to have foreign aid and we're going to send taxpayer dollars to foreign governments to help provide quality health care for low-income women in their countries, that we don't want to send that money to organizations that provide abortion and coerce those women in those countries to have abortion. So they wanted to, strip that prohibition to once again send money to their friends, such as International Planned Parenthood, that provide abortions. And, that's just extremely disappointing, especially since Nancy Pelosi just hours before invited all the children to come up on the podium with her for her swearing in. And then just hours later, she wanted to provide money that would, you know, take the lives of children in other countries. So it was disappointing. Other provisions besides reinstating this, sending the money to abortions through our foreign aid, was also to fund the UN Population Fund, which, of course, provides billions of dollars to China's coercive one-child policy. And we had stripped that money in the House version, and President Trump did not support putting money there. And once again, they wanted to support that. And they also wanted to send money to the District of Columbia for their physician-assisted suicide program. So, you know, I think this sadly shows where the priorities of Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats are now in the House, and that is to take away life and disregard it instead of affirming life, like the Republicans and I have been fighting for under when we were in the majority.
So Pelosi's really doubling down on this obstructionist agenda, and she's making good on her promise to have a pro-choice gavel when they win Congress, which is what she said during the midterm election season. So we're not really seeing anything surprising, but at this point, we understand that the funding measure is now headed to the Senate. What are your hopes when this bill heads to the Senate?
Well, I'm very hopeful that Senator McConnell will be good to his word and not bring it up for a vote. I mean, he has had indicated ahead of time, don't pass that. It's going to be dead on arrival. We're not going to take that up. And so I'm hopeful that it will go nowhere and that we can get serious about reopening government, fully funding it, but also keeping our priorities of affirming life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness through how we spend the taxpayer money in this country. And at the same time, recognizing that there's a real security concern at our southern border, and it's time that we prioritize national security for our families and provide that security at the border.
Now, we understand based on the incoming freshman class, it's been called the most diverse in recent history. And we understand that the progressive agenda is going to be pushed and was pushed by a lot of these candidates who have been recently sworn into office. What does that mean for you as such a staunch ally for the pro-life movement, hoping to accomplish things in the House of Representatives?
Well, it's going to mean that basically game on. We are going to be very vocal in opposing these efforts because I still believe that the vast majority of Americans respect and appreciate the traditional values that made this country great. They don't believe in socialism. They don't want their taxes raised so that they can spend it on all of these programs, which we cannot afford, where our national debt is just skyrocketing. We don't want taxpayer dollars going to spend for abortions. We do believe in a strong national defense. We do believe in the First Amendment and religious freedom, and we don't want those freedoms undergirded or overridden in our private lives and the way we run our businesses. And so, you know, we are going to be very vocal in opposing these, and hopefully we will, you know, have the help of the people, or your listeners and others across this country making phone calls and helping us to get the point across that this is not the direction we want to go. And I hope they will rethink this agenda, and we'll come together and look for common ground items that I believe are there to solve the problems our nation faces and to get to serious about working on those things instead of pushing these extreme agendas.
Congresswoman, you've noted that the economy has really taken an uptick. And just today we saw the announcement that 312 jobs have been added. It doesn't seem to be quite so much that Pelosi is interested in the economic security or border security of our country, but rather pushing an agenda like this. Is it going to be more of the same, you think, going into the remainder of this session?
Well, I think she's going to be surprised that, you know, the American people recognize that this economy is robust and it's growing and that consumer confidence is up. And like you said, 312,000 jobs just created last month. And I think it's over 202.7 million jobs created just since the beginning of last year. People had money. There was more spending at Christmas than we've had in years and years. And it's because of the positive policies that we put forth, the tax cuts and cutting the regulation.
Thanks, Congresswoman. You've been listening to Washington.
This Christmas, give a gift with purpose. Your gift to Family Research Council enables us to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a Christian worldview. Together, we will work to ensure religious liberty for all Americans is upheld, unborn babies in the womb are protected, and biblical values are honored in our country. Your giving can make an eternal difference for your community and for future generations. And if you give between now and December 31st to FRC, your gift will be doubled by a generous challenge match. Any donation is tax deductible. Be fruitful in your gift giving this season. Call 1-800-225-4008 or visit frc.org/2018 to donate. Again, that number is 1-800-225-4008 and frc.org/2018. Thank you for standing with us. FRC wishes you and your family a Merry Christmas and a Blessed New Year. Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Well, no one would accuse Senators Mazie Hirono and Senator Kamal Harris of being champions of religious liberty. And in fact, after skewering Amy Coney Barrett, Russell Vought, and other nominees who happen to be of particular religious persuasions, it shouldn't surprise anyone that Brian Boucher, who was the president's pick for U.S. District Judge in Nebraska, was next on their hit list. During his hearing in late November, the liberal duo insisted that anyone who was a member of a Catholic organization is incapable of being fair or impartial. In fact, Hirono argued, your beliefs don't suddenly go away because you become a judge. So there is no one better to talk about this controversy than my next guest. Carl Anderson has been the Supreme Knight of the Knights of Columbus since 2000. It is the world's largest Catholic fraternal service organization, has nearly 2 million members, and under his decade-long leadership, they have donated $1.5 billion and 700 million service hours to charitable causes. Mr. Anderson, thanks so much for joining me on Washington Watch.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be with you tonight.
So let's talk a little bit about the principles of the Knights of Columbus. What precisely are they, and what may have been the issue that these two extremely leftist senators had a problem with?
Well, the Knights of Columbus was established in Connecticut in 1882 on the principles of charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. So it was a time when there was some anti-immigrant feeling in the country, and religious minorities were, you know, exposed to some harshness that we don't always see today. So that was very much part of the founding of the Knights of Columbus. And also working men, how to take care of their family, especially if they became injured or they were killed on the job. There was no real social safety net. So that's what gave rise to the Knights of Columbus. But we spend a lot of time in charity. We have about 10,000 councils connected with local Catholic churches throughout the country, do a lot of charity, like you mentioned. And we also stand up for the teaching of the church, our Christian tradition, on things like marriage, pro-life, and other things. And I guess this is what caused the senators a problem, that our moral views on so many of these issues come from biblical teaching and our church teaching.
So we know that Article 6 forbids a religious test for public office. So we understand that the law is on our side, but unfortunately, popular opinion when it comes to some of our elected officials is not. So you've written recently about how this is really, this line of questioning is a bit of a stalking horse. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, a stalking horse is something you hide behind so you don't see the real target. And so we think they're using the Knights of Columbus as a stalking horse, but their real target is people of faith who base their moral position and many of their public policy positions on a biblical or a church teaching in terms of what our morality and our ethical structure should be. So they find us as the target, but the real target is, I think, people of faith. So FRC, faith, family, and freedom from a Christian perspective, that's good if you want to go into the free marketplace of ideas and say, okay, what's your views on pro-life? It's another thing to say, well, you know what, your view on pro-life is suspect because it's based on the Bible or it's based on what you may hear from the pulpit on Sunday. That's not really part of the American tradition. The American tradition is you have a free exercise of religion and you have freedom of conscience. That leads you to a different view. Let's go in the public square and debate it. But let's not rule certain people out because certain people have a faith tradition that somehow we might not find acceptable today.
Well, and it looks like what they're doing is targeting, for so many of us, traditional orthodoxy that has held fast for millennia, but has now suddenly come under the wave of public scrutiny as being too extreme. And I don't think there's any of us who would consider the views of the Catholic Church, the Knights of Columbus, or any other religious organization of the Christian faith to be too extreme. And yet, it looks like the senators themselves are the ones who are out of touch. The majority of Americans still believe that marriage should be between one man and one woman. Do we need to be concerned about future confirmation hearings with judges who might be members of the Knights of Columbus or of the Catholic tradition and faith?
Well, I think it's when you apply the kind of questions that we've seen in this case, it's a blatant violation of that constitutional guarantee against a religious test for public office. That's very clear. And whether it's a nominee for a judgeship who's a member of the Knights of Columbus or whether it's Secretary of State Pompeo, who's challenged during his confirmation hearings about his religious faith and how that leads him to make certain decisions on moral questions. So I think it can apply across the board. And I think we have to be very, very careful about that. And as you mentioned, it's quite ironic, right? Because the year that California voted for Barack Obama, California voters passed Proposition 8. At the same election when African-American voters in California voted 90% for Barack Obama, they voted 70% in favor of Proposition 8. So why is it that Knights of Columbus or Catholic support of Proposition 8 somehow is extreme, but not these other people? So,
Carl, thanks for being with us today.
Careful.
Appreciate all of your fighting back against the religious bigotry. I am Sarah Perry, and for Tony Perkins, we'll be right back.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect. This Christmas, give a gift with purpose. Your gift to Family Research Council enables us to advance faith, family, and freedom. Together, we will work to protect life, marriage, and religious liberty in our country. If you give before December 31st to FRC, your gift will be doubled. Be fruitful in your gift giving this season. Call 1-800-225-4008 or visit frc.org/2018. FRC wishes you and your family a Merry Christmas and a Blessed New Year.
Don't miss your opportunity to join other like-minded people and become an FRC STAN member. Join today and you'll receive empowering resources like Tony Perkins' book, No Fear, and for a limited time, Pastor Carter Conlon's book, It's Time to Pray. So become an FRC STAN member for $17 a month. That's just 56 cents a day. To join, call 1-800-225-4008 or visit frc.org/stan. Thank you for partnering with us for the sake of America.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Wow, we have had a lot to talk about this time around. We always do, but I'm particularly excited about my next guest who runs an incredible ministry. Apple's online store removed his app. It is a Christian group called Hope, Living Hope Ministries, after a pro-homosexual group named Truth Wins Out objected to it and ran a petition that garnered a whopping 356 signatures. That's right. But it was good enough to pressure Tim Cook, Apple's founder, to remove the app from the App Store. So joining me today on Washington Watch on the Newsmaker Hotline is Ricky Shillette, Executive Director of Living Hope Ministries from Arlington, Texas. Ricky, thanks so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Okay, let's talk first about the app. Can you explain to us what the app was designed to do that would have made it so controversial for pro-homosexual organizations?
Well, what the app was designed to do is allow individuals just an easy way to access our resources and our testimonials, Bible studies, and that sort of thing, to make it convenient for people to access that. And I'm not really sure why it's so incredibly controversial in that our app pretty much has the same kind of information that you would find on your typical evangelical, orthodox, biblical church site. Most of the teachings that are there that I do are exegetical teachings of books of the Bible, and so you will find a number of books of the Bible that I go through verse by verse. Now, we make some application, obviously, knowing that the folks who come to Living Hope are often dealing with sexual and relational struggles in their life. We know that's our audience, and so as a result of that, I gear the sermons toward addressing issues that are related to that. But ultimately, they're sermons that you probably could hear in pretty much any church anywhere in America.
But you just happen to collate them and make the resource available for people who are volunteering, who are seeking it out to use it of their own free will, right?
That is absolutely correct, and that is a really significant aspect of why we were kind of shocked when this happened, in that we don't promote or advertise or pay for advertisement or seek to enlist anyone or force anyone, certainly, to download this app. This is a completely voluntary thing that a person does of their own volition. And so if you're seeking the app and you're opening the app and you're reading the content, it's because you decided to do that. We certainly couldn't force you to do that.
So Truth Wins Out, executive director, told NBC X gay programs are consumer fraud and cause significant harm to the people they purport to help. We want to thank Apple for exemplifying corporate responsibility. Well, after only 356 signatures, are you surprised that it took that little to get Tim Cook to alter course on your app?
Well, I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed, because I think that in an age where diversity and tolerance is being pushed at every in every venue, I would hope that that kind of acceptance and tolerance and diversity would be accepted in the area of religious expression. And obviously, the position that we hold is one of biblical truth that has been accepted by Christendom for literally thousands of years. And so I don't think that anything we're offering is terribly controversial or new, in the sense that it is the teaching of God's word as he's revealed it to us for, you know, that, and Christians and others have followed this for thousands of years.
So let me ask you a question here. We have an issue in big tech. We've talked about this before on Washington Watch, where there seems to be a bit of a steamroll in the industry, understanding that there is a patent left-wing liberal bias to those who operate out of Silicon Valley. Were you aware, and if so, were you surprised that Tim Cook himself is identified as homosexual? And how do you think this particular situation affected him? And what would you say if he were here with you and you had a chance to talk to him face-to-face about the application that you've designed?
Yeah, I mean, I am aware that he is identified as gay, and I doubt very seriously that he even knows about the app. I'm sure this was a decision that was made by, you know, some other person in a much lower level within the corporation. I'm aware that most companies are very, very sensitive to this particular issue, simply because it receives an awful lot of media attention and an awful lot of press. But again, I think that many of the accusations that were made by Truth Wins Out were accusations that were not necessarily truthful. And so if Tim were sitting across from me talking to him, I would tell him, you know, that I wish he would look at the app. I wish he would listen to the testimonies. I wish he would watch the videos that are on our site and realize that though he may have chosen to go the route that he's pursuing, and that's his right to do that, and we certainly appreciate the right of Tim to make those choices, we would say that there are other people who are conflicted between their faith and their feelings, and they would like to make other kinds of choices. And so all we're doing is offering the opportunity for folks who are conflicted between what they believe religiously and spiritually and what they feel. We offer them a way to reconcile that and find congruence between those faith and feelings in a way that's consistent with scriptural truth. And I think folks ought to be able to have, as adults, the opportunity to make those sort of choices in their life.
Ricky, we have some audio from Tim Cook during a recent presentation at an investors conference, and it gives sort of a little bit of an insight into how he views the big picture in the context of technology. Yep.
At Apple, we believe that technology needs to have a clear point of view.
Perfect.
On this challenge. That's why we only have one message for those who seek to push hate, division, and violence. You have no place on our platforms.
We got another clip that gives a little bit more insight into exactly where Apple stands as a corporation.
From the earliest days of iTunes to Apple Music today, we have always prohibited music with a message of white supremacy. Why? Because it's the right thing to do. At Apple, we are not afraid to say that our values drive our curation decisions. I believe the most sacred thing that each of us is given is our judgment, our morality, our own innate desire to separate right from wrong. Choosing to set that responsibility aside at a moment of trial is a sin.
Okay, so he uses the word sin, Ricky. That's a bit of a bellwether for his organization, but particularly for someone like you who works in a ministry designed to publish God's truth and to give that truth to the individuals that are struggling with their definition of truth. How does that strike you when he said that that's a sin?
Well, I'm glad he feels as though folks need to have their own sacred judgment and that he wants them to have the right to be able to discern right and wrong. I would 100% agree with that. I believe that that is what we want people to do as well. And to call it a sin, I would say restricting people from the ability to make those choices, yeah, that would be not a good choice to make. When he says that he wants to make sure that he separates from hate, division, and violence, once again, I think if he would listen to what we're actually saying, he would realize that in the 30-year ministry that we've been in existence, we've done incredible work to reconcile families and young men and young women with their parents that were estranged. We've helped parents make sure that they continue to love and support and care for their gay-identified children, even when those children desire not to have a relationship with them. We have done, you know, incredible and intentional work to make sure that people's relationships are preserved and that individuals are honored as the image bearers of God that they are. And I think if he would just listen to and read the stuff that we have, he would see that that is what we talk about on a regular basis. When I go into churches and I'm speaking with churches, the main thing that I talk to them is how do you respond redemptively to those who are identified in the LGBTQ community. I love gay people. I love gay-identified people. I love all people. And so I want to make sure that the church has a message of hope. And to me, the greatest message of love is exemplified in the work of Christ and the truth of Christ. And so for me to say that I love you, but yet not proclaim to you the truth of God, that he has a design for your life and a plan for your life and a way for your life, would be then not to love you in the way that Christ has asked us to love.
So I hear passion in your voice, and I know where from you speak, and I know that this is not just an academic or a theological discussion for you, that you come from a place of real knowledge and awareness on the issue. Can you share a little bit of your personal story with our listeners?
Sure. You know, I was born with a mom and dad, and my mom and dad are still together, and they tried really hard to be great parents, and I love them very much and care for them very much. And from the time I was very young, my dad worked out of town a lot and wasn't present a lot, and as a result of that, I didn't have a lot of masculine influence in my life. I didn't have a lot of men around. My mom had two sisters. They were divorced, and a couple of grandmothers. They were divorced as well, and so I didn't have a lot of male influence. And about, you know, when I was a very young little boy, one of my grandmothers married for the third time, and when she did, I suddenly had a wonderful step-grandfather that came into my life, and that was very exciting to me. He was a really neat guy and loved on me and liked me a lot and took special interest in me, but what our family didn't know about him is that he was a pedophile, and he began to molest me at a really young age, and that continued on a very consistent and regular basis for more than a decade. And in the course of all of that taking place, I just thought it was something that people did with their grandfather. I didn't know that it was necessarily wrong. And I can even remember times when I entered into puberty that I would initiate things with him simply because it felt good and I felt loved and he would affirm me and love on me and tell me great things about who I was and how much he was proud of me. And I longed for that kind of attention and affirmation and affection. And so as a result of that, by the time I got into high school, I realized that, wow, I have an attraction for other males, and some of my even good friends I had odd feelings for that I knew I shouldn't have, but I had. And it wasn't like I couldn't have accepted homosexuality. We had gay-identified people in our extended family, and they were loved and embraced and celebrated, and they were very successful. So I felt as though I could have done that, and I didn't have a Christian home per se. I wasn't raised in the church, and so I could have easily, you know, accepted that. But there was something internally within me that said, this isn't right, and I tried really hard with a little bit of religion that I did have to pray that the gay would go away, so to speak. But the reality was, in all that praying, nothing really changed. And at some point, or there, about my senior year of high school, actually, I thought, wow, I'm super depressed. I'm sad that I can't make this go away. Maybe I just need to make me go away. And I, as a very good kid, wanting not to be gay, decided that I would go into my mom's medicine cabinet and grab all the medication I could, and I tried to overdose. That wasn't successful. But then about 2 weeks later, I actually felt even more depressed because I'd failed at killing myself and decided that I would grab a gun. And I grabbed a pistol and went to my room late one evening, shut the door and locked it, and knelt down at the side of my bed, put the pistol in my mouth, and was about to blow my brains out. And suddenly in that moment, I had remembered some messages of the gospel that I had heard from a friend of mine who had invited me to his church. And I remember them talking about this Jesus and how Christ could save you, and that the power of the resurrection that raised Jesus from the dead could be available to me if I would just trust in him. And when I heard it, I thought it was a silly message of weak-minded people, to be honest. I discounted it. But in that moment of desperation, I realized it might be the only hope that I had. And so I pulled the gun out of my mouth and I prayed out loud, God, I don't know if you're real, I don't know if you're true, I don't know if you can do what they say you can do, but if you don't do it in this moment, I'm going to pull this trigger and paint the wall red. And in that moment, the Lord showed up to me in that room. He wasn't physically there, but in my heart and soul, I know that I was embraced by the Spirit of God. And I stood up that night, and I still had a family that was dysfunctional and a grandfather that would pursue me, and I still had all kinds of struggles and difficulties, but I knew when I stood up that night in my soul that I was promised that he would never leave me or forsake me, and he would be a father to the fatherless. Now, I didn't know those were scriptures. I'd never read those scriptures before, but I knew in my heart that those promises were given to me. And later, as I grew in my relationship with Jesus, I discovered those to be the scriptures of promise for us. And that has served me well through all these years. Now, you know, I still struggle. I still struggle with sin of all kinds, but I still even can struggle with this sin. But I've learned that my feelings do not define me, and my past does not determine my future. And so now I have been wonderfully and gloriously married to a beautiful woman for the last 30 years, and I love it. I've been serving in the church for 30 plus years, and God has done an incredible work in my life, and all that I desire to do through our ministry is to offer that hope and that grace and that love to those who are seeking a different path. And for those who aren't, then God bless them, and they can pursue whatever they want to pursue. But for those who want to find Jesus and be more intimately related to him, I want to offer the opportunity for them to do that and find the freedom and the hope and the love that I've experienced myself.
Ricky, that is an incredible testimony. I don't know if anybody else hears it and doesn't choke up like I did, but I have to tell you, I am praying that there's someone out there who hears this message today and needs to connect with Living Hope Ministries. If people need to find you, if they want to connect with you, how do they do that?
Our website is livehope.org, livehope.org, and there's a contact tab there that they can contact us and send us an email. Like I said, there's all kinds of testimonies and videos that are on there, as well as lots of articles they can read about who we are, where we are, what we believe, that sort of thing. We also have podcasts that they can download from their favorite podcast supplier or place where they download podcasts. It's called Hopecast by Living Hope Ministries, and that one's a little more fun, but it also tells about, you know, who we are, what we do, and how
Thanks.
We do what we do.
Thanks,
we
Ricky.
Have you know,
Ricky,
we
we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on Washington Watch. God bless you in your ministry. I've been Sarah Perry in for Tony Perkins, and we will see you next week.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.